Chapter 12, Day 263. The Machanites, 1333. The previous day, fate, or the beneficence of the God Emperor of Man, had decreed them clear passage up through the cold, winding passes through the mountains. Not a hint of war had touched them. Not an Auspex contact, not even the distant murmur of a warplane overhead. Their flasks and cans replenished with cool, brackish water from mountain rills. They had raced ahead, buoyed with a sense of sudden expectation and hope. At nightfall, where previously Le Guin had ordered a rest stop to take advantage of the lower temperatures, they had pressed on, edging on through the dark, grinding along the bottoms of gorges and rock cuts, thundering up across pebble-strewn slopes. At some hour after midnight, the column passed over the spine of the mountains at a place called Ragnar's Cut, and began its descent into the broad foothills of the north. Viltry rode with the line of death. He had been offered the place of a gunner killed on the road some days before. He wasn't expected to perform any tasks. He was simply a passenger. Le Guin took a turn driving in the mid-period to relieve the weary Emdeen. Emdeen climbed into the commander's turret seat and immediately fell asleep. In the bare metal rocker seat of the sponson below, Viltry found slumber harder to achieve. The noise of the Pardus tank was ferocious, and its motion far more violent than any plane, even under bad turbulence. It was a vibration, a shaking, not at all like the fluid variances of flight. Loose rocks thrown up by the treads clattered against the heavy hull and the track guards. It was hot, despite the night chill outside, and the moist air reeked of smoke and oil and unwashed flesh. There was also nothing to see. The night was moonless, the dark enclosing. The convoy elements moved with hooded lamps. Within the tank, there was merely the red cabin light and the glow of the thick glass displays. When Le Guin called out that they had at last passed over the top of the Machanite Ridge, Viltry simply had to take the tanker's word for it. Dawn came in, grey and heavy. Emdeen resumed his driving, and Le Guin and Viltry sat in the turret with the hatches open. The air, cold and damp and filled with exhaust from the long line of trundling machines, was at least refreshing after the stuffy interior. There was still very little to see. The trail curled down through bare, grey foothills, snaking through a boulder-strewn landscape that seemed devoid of natural growth. Mist choked the valley beyond, stealing away any distant view. Behind them, the Machanites were towers of shadow against a bleached, starved sky. The sun rose, but the mist refused to clear, and they bore on down into a layer of haze and poor visibility. They passed by three Imperial troop trucks, abandoned by the side of the track, evidence of a previous column fleeing this way, and then, at about 10, overhauled the tail end of it. It was twice the size of Le Guin's contingent, and moving much more slowly. They fell in pace with it. Le Guin moved his machine right to the head of his section of the formation and made vox contact with the second column's leaders. From the exchanges Viltry could overhear, their new companions were travelling under the same sort of ad hoc command as Le Guin's segment. Proper lines of command through the tank and infantry forces had long since been lost. It appeared the tankers, like Le Guin, due to the fact that they were now the defending escort of thousands of truck-bound troops, were calling the shots by necessity. Le Guin seemed particularly pleased to hear that several tank crews from his own regiment were riding with the other column. He exchanged tart, joking vox conversations with a captain called Wall.
"Good to hear his voice," Le Guin said to Viltry, as he settled the vox horn back onto its cradle. "I'd heard rumours that old Strontium had been destroyed at the Trinity Gates. The old rascal."
Viltry understood Le Guin's delight. He too would have been happy to hear from old friends presumed dead. Not that it was going to happen. The mist began to thin, but the day did not lighten. They had reached sparse forest, and the limits of what seemed to be a metalled roadway. The valley of the Leader, heading down all the way to the coast. Others had come this way before them. There were more abandoned vehicles on or by the road, many stripped of equipment. They passed a number of farm stations and agro-complexes that had been deserted by their inhabitants, possibly weeks before. The places had been comprehensively looted of all stock. Store barns and silos were empty, habs ransacked or burned out. Livestock pens and the huge tin rotundas of poultry hatcheries were broken down and empty. In some fields, they sighted rows of fresh graves. The road approached the river, following its course. More ruined farms stood along its banks, homesteads and land parcel stations, then a whole village, empty and gutted. At noon, they came up on a line of burned-out, exploded vehicle wrecks, jumbled along kilometres of road that had been badly holed and cratered. The action was at least 3 days old. Tanks with dozer blades and the few remaining Atlas tractors had to clear some of the wrecks aside to permit progress. It had been an airstrike. Viltry could see all the signs. After that, damage became more commonplace. The remains of other convoy elements littered further shot-up sections of highway. Unburied, blackened corpses lay in the roadside ditches. More bodies, swollen, floated face down in the pools of a ruined roadside hydroponics system. All of the next three townships had been bombed to extinction by heavy raids rather than just looted and forsaken. This was now an eerie, miserable landscape to drive through. Thousands of hectares of field systems had been burned black by uncontrolled firebomb damage. Farms, villages, entire townships had been levelled. There were stretches of forest where nothing remained but blast-splintered trunks protruding from cindered earth. Craters, many filled with rainwater, punctured the landscape for kilometres. Smashed hydroponic systems leaked rivers of algae-rich soup down across the roadway from ruptured dikes. The column moved on, hissing water up into the air. It was no longer mist that stained the sky. It was smoke residue from the days of raiding and fire dust kicked up by their wheels and tracks. Down the wide, wounded valley, their scopes identified other communities, shelled to death, wreathed with the grey vapour of firestorms that had blazed, unchecked, for days. At 13:33, an alert was given. 10 kilometres north, bright flashes underlit the clouds, and they heard the crump of munitions. A few minutes later, a formation of enemy warplanes was sighted, heading south at medium altitude. The machines, their payloads already dropped, ignored the straggling column, but there was no doubt they had been sighted. The contact would be called in. The Imperial column had begun crossing a miraculously unscathed bridge over a Leiden tributary just after 1400, when a second alert came through. It had started to rain, and the Auspex refused to give a clean track. An air of confusion and panic rose in the convoy around them. Le Guin cleared his weapon batteries and then got on the Vox.
"Say again. Track reading. Confirm track reading for hostiles."
Just frantic chatter.
"Come on," Le Guin snarled into the Vox. "This is line of death. Give me a track reading. Get it together."
Viltry opened the top hatch and craned up at the overcast sky, smelling the cold, wet air, listening. The sound of agitated voices came from all around. Throbbing engines, the noise of turret motors as weapons traversed, the timpani of rain pattering off the armour. And there, concealed behind it all, the warble of vector thrust engines. Viltry glanced anxiously down at Le Guin.
"What?" Le Guin asked, standing up.
"Hear it?"
"Where? Wait. Yes, it's ahead of us."
"No," said Viltry. "That's an acoustic bounce off the valley. It's behind us."
Le Guin instantly began spinning the executioner's turret to face rear.
"Get us off the bridge," he yelled at Emdeen.
"Get moving,"
Viltry shouted from the hatch to the trucks all around.
"Come on, clear the way. Get these vehicles rolling."
Over two-thirds of the column had still to cross the bridge's ancient pilings. Viltry heard a change in the vector note.
"Here they come," he yelled.
Someone back down the convoy had at last got a decent track too. From the end of the long line of vehicles forward, weapon mounts began to fire at the sky. Pintle weapons, elevated cannons, the few Hydra platforms still carrying munitions. Small arms opened up as well, men standing up at the back of trucks to unload las rifles into the sky. Hundreds of other guardsmen, unarmed or too scared to make such a bold defiance, scrambled out of their transports and ran for cover in the trees and amongst the reed beds of the tributary. The firing was intense. The convoy's elevated shooting filled the rainy sky with a blizzard of white-hot or illuminated rounds. There was still no sign of the hostiles.
"They're wasting most of it," Viltry said, noticing that Le Guin at least had not started firing.
Le Guin was about to speak. Something went over, northwards, low and very fast. The jet wash shook them, and their ears popped. A brief hint of something mauve or dark red.
Less than a second later, there was a dull, hollow thump. Rippling around itself, a large ball of flame boiled up into the sky on a neck of smoke and sparks some 300 meters behind them. Viltry saw the second bat, a hell talon. It had just sat its bomb load on the very tail end of the column and had clearly hit something significant. A tank, an ammo carrier maybe. A curtain of bright, almost neon-white flame rushed into the air way behind them. Small black specks, which Viltry realized were very probably large pieces of detonating vehicle, flew sideways out of the flash wake. The Talon kept low, switching to cannon to rake the convoy. The noise of its jets was terrifying. Crouched in what seemed like a very fragile drum of metal, Viltry experienced the psychological impact of an air attack for the first time. He virtually froze, his body refusing to respond. His teeth chattered. No. His teeth were chattering because Le Guin had opened fire with the main weapons, the twin-linked autocannons, adding his force to the AA storm. The whole turret shook and started to turn as it tracked. Gripping the edges of the hatch, Viltry stared at the incoming Talon. A stream of green tracer shot from a Hydra nearly struck it. It banked slightly, almost daintily, refusing to be deterred from its long, hammering run. Its cannons were firing. Fast blinks of light flash flickered around the recessed weapon mounts. Whipping, concussive impacts stripped up the line of the road. A Cargo 8 shuddered violently as if men with rock drills were working in its flatbed. Its canvas cargo hood shredded, its windows blew out, and its tires burst. Bodywork seams split and exhaled dust and smoke. A second Cargo 8, just ahead of it, lurched and immediately caught fire. Viltry saw men burning like brush torches staggering out of the cab. Still running, the truck left the road, bounced down the embankment, and rolled on its side in the reed beds, hissing up a thick cloud of steam as river water hit fire. The Talon rushed overhead. Viltry flinched as one of its shells glanced off the line's forearmor. Le Guin's shots streamed after it, but missed.
"Not enough deflection," Viltry shouted.
"What?"
"Deflection! You're not anticipating him right."
"Can you do better?" Le Guin asked.
"I can try," Viltry replied.
Le Guin ordered Matrides down into the lower compartment to free an autoloader that was sticking. He himself switched seats to the commander's position and allowed Viltry to drop into the gunner's seat.
"Bear in mind, this isn't a dedicated AA vehicle," Le Guin cautioned.
"I know," said Viltry.
"I mean, we don't have a Hydra's elevation or targeters. I'm just trying to throw up some fire."
"I know,"
Viltry repeated. He was looking around the turret fixtures, familiarizing himself with them.
"Traverse?"
"There,"
said Le Guin, pointing to a two-way clutch lever.
"You know what you're doing."
"Well, there are some differences, but it's not that different from a Marauder turret."
Viltry sat back, getting used to the prismatic sight, and test swung the turret about.
"You were doing pretty well, by the way," Viltry said. "But it's a predictive thing. You're not used to airborne targets. You're thinking they're going to move like an arrow or a dart, but vector thrust don't do that. They'll come up or to the side in a weird way."
Emdeem had them off the bridge now. Parts of the rearward column were burning fiercely.
"More coming," Le Guin called,
one hand up to his earphones. The Hydra batteries on the road started up again. Viltry strained to see out of the limited scope.
"They're coming for the bridge. They want this column stopped right here."
Viltry started the turret turning and then began firing. God Emperor, it was slow and lumbering and almost like firing blind. The Talon went over, unharmed. Viltry began to realize why Le Guin had been struggling. The line of death had been built for savage anti-personnel action, not air cover. He swung the turret back fast, immediately picking up a second Talon on its inward path. Viltry used the smoke plumes from burning wrecks along the road as a scale, then began firing again at the air above the bridge, the point at which he was sure the hostile would start to lift out. Elevated as high as they would go, the line of death's twin cannons punched heavy fire at the clouds, and that stream began to swish in a horsetail as Viltry dragged the turret around, aiming not for the Talon, but for where the Talon would be when the rounds had covered the distance. Nearly. Nearly. The Hell Talon, blue-striped with bone white, tried to whiff hard at the last second, but its forward rate was too high for any kind of instant adjustment. It flew right through the line's fuselage. Riddled, the airframe tore open, fragments flying off. The tank rocked as it went over. The Talon sliced across the main river on one wingtip, then pancaked and hit the far shore. A throaty explosion followed. Matrides, Emdeem, and the other crewmen started whooping and cheering. Le Guin punched Viltry on the shoulder.
"That was mainly luck," said Viltry.
"Another one,"
the loader shouted, looking at an Auspex reader.
Viltry swung around again. It was coming in much lower. He wasn't going to get anything like as good a lead on this shot. He fired anyway, washing the turret back and forth to extend the cone, an old tail gunner's trick. All of it missed, but the raking fire restricted the Talon's line of attack, and it flew straight into sustained fire from a Hydra. The moment the four long-barreled autocannons of the Hydra found the enemy machine, the targeter system took over and held the guns right on it. On powered traverse, the Hydra managed to maintain heavy hits for over 105 degrees of turn. The Talon began to climb and then blew up in a ragged yellow flash, raining debris down over the river and road. After that, no more raiders came down the valley for a while. Le Guin shook Viltry by the hand. Viltry was breathing hard, pulse racing. For the first time since G for Greta had been brought down, he felt as if he had a purpose, a worth. He'd helped keep the bridge clear. The feeling tasted a little like the confidence he'd been slowly winning back on Enothis, the reassurance of a point to life that Becca Mayer's company had begun to coax back into him. The crash had torn that confidence away, of course. But now he felt oddly centered. War claimed men. They died. Machines crashed. Leaders, like Viltry, felt guilt and remorse. It would ever be the way, for in the galaxy of man, there is only war. For one tiny but valuable moment, sitting there in the executioner's turret, surrounded by the cheering and bellowing of men he hardly knew, Viltry realized that guilt and remorse would truly be his to bear if he didn't make the effort to live. To live, to fight the foes of man, and to make his way back to find the woman who had shown kindness to a stranger. The column began to move again. The rain grew heavier, and they pulled the hatches shut. The valley ahead was an ashen, dispirited place, and there was a great distance to go before they reached the cities, far away, where the skies were already banded with black fire smoke. Lake Gosal FSB, 1912. In the space of about 30 hours, their alarm bracelets had fired 18 times. With jarring regularity, they were stirred from exercise, prep, sleep, meals, and standby in order to rush to the shelters as enemy formations passed through their airspace. Each period of waiting in the gloom of the dugouts did nothing to soothe already stretched nerves. There was a fight between two Navy fitters and some PDF troopers, and a face-to-face row between Ramfrey and one of the Raptor pilots, which was only diffused by the calm intervention of Millen Blancher. The worst argument occurred between Jagdia and Blager. The FSB had lofted only 3 snap calls in the period, and for the rest of the time it had hidden under its camo at the first sign of an alert. "What possible good are we doing?" she was heard shouting. Blager's argument, supported by Marcinin and the leader of the Lightning Wing, was that Gosal FSB was under strength as an intercept force and should therefore pick its targets. 7 of the alerts had been triggered by mass raid formations of bombers, 300 or 400 machines strong, passing north towards the coast. Gosal's 3 wings would barely make a dent in such formidable numbers, and launches would betray the base's carefully concealed location. There was no doubt that a mass raid force would spare a bomber pack to annihilate the source of the ambushes if it was discovered.
"Better to stay low, observe concealment discipline, and only respond to targets we can deal with safely," Blager told her.
"But in another day or two, there'll be so many bats up there, we won't be flying at all. We're supposed to be intercept, so let's damn well intercept something."
"You're talking about a willful and suicidal approach to the prosecution of this conflict."
"I'm talking," growled Jagdia, "about fighting this war instead of sitting it out."
Late in the afternoon, the 4th sortie of the day was permitted. Coastal Operations had requested urgent data gathering from its FSBs along the Surya. There was a pressing need to assess the disposition of inbound retreat elements so the Munitorum could more effectively accomplish the mass land evacuation, an operation already beginning at Ezraville and Theda. Operations also hoped to locate one or more of the enemy land carriers. Given the terrible strength of the raids now being suffered, it was presumed that several mass carriers were currently established in the northern desert, and operations clearly longed to be able to steer in marauder strikes to ease the ferocity of the bombing campaign. Word was that not a single town or city along the littoral and the peninsula remained untouched. Quite apart from the huge armor and troop evacuation taking place on the seacoast, a vast civilian exodus had also begun. Deprived for the most part of sea transit or Munitorum aid,
The citizens of the littoral were fleeing west towards Ingeborg and the northern affiliation in vast, haphazard caravans. Reports of the public panic and mayhem were filtering through. Several civilian convoys had been hit. The losses were so distressing, Jagdeer couldn't bring herself to repeat what she'd read to the pilots and crew of Umbra. 3 recon lightnings were to go up on a wide track, with a trio of thunderbolts riding shotgun. According to dispersal rotation, this escort was due to be provided by the Raptors. Blager himself was slated to fly, but he clearly felt uneasy about what Jagdeer might try to pull if he was absent from the FSB. Blager suggested that, if she was so keen to get airborne, the Fantine might take the job. Jagdeer saw through his ploy. A new Umbra would be better served if she stayed. She declined, citing the damage her Thunderbolt had sustained on her last sortie. In truth, it had already been fully repaired by her devoted techs, but they knew what to tell Blager if he asked, and deliberately removed Serial 02's cowling to act out a pantomime of repair work. Jagdeer sent Ash in her place, with Walden and Zemek. Markwall could barely hide his disappointment. With 9-9 fixed and cleared for flight, he was overdue a run, and should have been chosen over either Zemek or Walden. After the 6 machines had launched, and the shimmer nets wound back into place, Jagdeer went to find him. Markwall was in his habby tent, playing regicide with Van Tull. "Got a moment?" she asked.
"I've got things to do, ma'am," Van Tull said, and made himself scarce.
"Get your flight suit on," she said to Markwall. "I'm moving you up to snap call standby." Markwall nodded, but his expression was glum.
"I should have gone on the last run."
"You know that." "It depends what you mean by should, Vander," she said. "You and Larice aren't the best of friends right now. Keeping you out of each other's way is probably a good idea." Markwall blushed, but it was largely anger.
"She," he began. "I don't know what I've done."
"You haven't known Larice long, Vander. Not like me. I know what she's like. One of the best pilots it's been my honor to fly with, but also headstrong, proud, full of ambition, and a compulsion to prove herself all the time. It's her temperament, to fly the best, get the best score, and be seen associating with the hottest of her male comrades. You had something there that she liked the look of, a reputation in the making. But then, that mislaunch."
"I was a laughingstock."
"For about 10 minutes. I haven't heard it mentioned since. But Larice, well, that was a blow to her pride. She'd made a show of picking you as the next big thing, and there you were suddenly, the subject of scorn. Now you might wince and shrug it off, but Larice's pride gets in the way. She felt something of that laughter was at her expense, and maybe it was."
"So she just cuts me? Freezes me out? Drops me as fast as she latched onto me?"
"I'm afraid that's her way," Jagdeer said.
"Great," Markwall said.
"Larice is strong, as a pilot. As a person, she's unusually fragile. I know it's easy to say, Vander, but just move on. There's a war to wage. Another sortie or two, I'm certain you'll soon be getting back in your stride, building on the promise you've shown. It wouldn't surprise me if she became interested in you all over again," Markwall snorted. "Of course, once bitten," Jagdeer smiled. By 1900 hours, as evening began to drape across the lake, the recon flight and its escort went overdue. Last transmission had been routine, 40 minutes before. No Vox response. Nothing on the Auspex or Modar. The pilots of Umbra gathered, pacing and chatting nervously. The mood in the camp, under the claustrophobic spread of the netting, became charged. "I want to take a flight up, combat air patrol, take a look for the missing planes," Jagdeer said to Commander Marcinon.
"Request denied," said Marcinon. "For now, at least. Let's not get precious. They've got an hour left in their tanks."
"Depending on how they've been flying," said Jagdeer. "One serious air brawl, and you can halve that. I repeat my request." They were standing in the operations room. Circulation fans whirred overhead, and by the light of caged glow globes, Navy tactical officers sat before flickering, empty displays.
"Anything?" Marcinon called.
"Some activity in quadrants 4 and 9-2, Commander," reported the chief operator. "Enemy movements, but way off. Nothing from our flight."
"They can't all have been stung," murmured Oberlitz, the chief of the Lightning Wing, the 786th, giving voice to the private fear they had all been hiding.
Oberlitz was a short, square-set man with thin lips that he licked as a nervous habit. Like Jagdeer, he was now anxious about his crews. She had an ally of sorts against Marcinon and the chief of the raptors. "I formally repeat my request," said Jagdeer. "Let me get machines up now before the situation changes and we're forced to lie low with the net sealed." Marcinon looked at Blager. Blager nodded. "Request granted," said Marcinon. Jagdeer ran out of the operations block. The pilots had congregated outside. "Blancher, Markwell, we're up. Let's go." Their machines were already on the ramps. By the time the three pilots had suited up and checked their kit, the fitters had finished pre-flight. Jagdeer, Blancher, and Markwell ran up to the mat decks, and the ground crews locked them tight in their cockpits. "Check back," Jagdeer voxed.
"Two here. 4A.
"This is 8. Ready for go?" Markwell felt his heart rate climbing. He reached out and stroked the edge of the main instrument panel.
"This time, you hear me, 99," he whispered. "This time, no games, no jinx. Just Vander Markwell and Double Eagle."
The last cues were chopping out from operations over the Vox. The nets began to crank back. Buzzer. 5 seconds. The last of the fitter crew ran to the cover of the blast fences. Markwell sat his thumb on the rocket fire stud.
"You are go, Umbra Flight," the Vox announced.
Markwell squeezed the stud, and gravity slammed him back into his seat. Over the forests, 1930. They climbed into the dusk, their burners the brightest things in the air. The sky was violet, streaked with 3/10 cloud, 10 kilometers to the west. Below, the forest sprawled, almost black.
"Make your height 9,000, cruising," Jagdeer called. "Track is 4-4-2.
"Understood, lead," said Blancher.
"Received,"
Markwell answered. For the first 30 seconds of the flight, he'd been watching the board, waiting for a malfunction light to flash on. Nothing. Even the engines sounded sweet. In the east, against the darkest part of the sky, stars had begun to rise. Visibility was so good that Markwell could make out distant flashes against the undercast in the far northwest, hundreds of kilometers away, a display like sheet lightning that he knew was pattern bombing. They flew south for 15 minutes, then tracked gently west. After another slow 20 minutes, Markwell heard Blanche's call.
"Contact! Strong! Inbound! 20 kilometers.
He sent the signal to the other bolts, and their AllSpec systems tracked the lock.
"They're under us. 4,000. 2 groups, Jagdeer's voice said. "Stay at this height. Turn onto them. Operations, are you seeing this?"
"Copy, Umbra lead, but with no more detail than you've got."
"Closing. Weapons live. Flight. Stay tight."
Another pause. Just the mighty throb of the engines and the hiss of the air mix. Markwell stared down into the darkness of the forest twilight. The contacts should have been coming into visual, but it was all too black. Wisps of night cloud were forming at 5,000, like banners of smoke.
"I have transponder tracks," Blancher called. "Clean signals. It's Walden, and at least one of the lightnings."
Umbra 9, this is Umbra Leader, high side and inbound. Do you copy?"
A squeal of static disrupted the channel. Then they heard Walden's voice. Even with the distortion, there was a note of fear in it. Fear or pain.
Umbra leader, this is 9. Say again."
"Coming in on you, 9. What's your situation?"
Assistance,
another voice cut in, blotting Walden out.
"Identify user," Jagdeer called.
"This is Spyglass 4, Umbra, requesting immediate assistance."
One of the lightnings. The pilot sounded petrified.
"Situation, please," Jagdeer called again.
Both the lightning pilot and Walden attempted to answer at the same time, and the result was a mangle of signals. Markwell was still peering down. He saw a glint, a faint trace of thruster flame. Then, against the blackness, several tiny little streaks of light. There and gone.
"Lead, this is 8. Their situation is they're under attack. I see weapons fire. Repeat, I see weapons fire."
"Stoop and sting," Jagdeer called.
The three Thunderbolts banked over and went into a power dive. As they closed, the jumbled merging AllSpec returns resolved. There were 4 machines below them, Walden flying close cover behind a lightning, and 2 unidentifieds running after them. Walden was sweeping his machine from side to side. They came in. The sky lit up with gunfire traces. Markwell saw the lightning. It had been shot up and was trailing long streamers of hot smoke that had blurred the AllSpec track. Walden was at its 6.
About 750 meters behind them, two locusts were closing in, weapons pumping. Walden's bird took several hits. Metal spalled off it in a spray that caught the last of the daylight. Markwell couldn't believe what he was seeing. Walden was actually trying to use his better-armored machine to shield the struggling recon plane. He had never seen anything so selfless, and Esper. Esper had done the same for Markwell.
"Walden!" Jagdeer yelled. "Ammo gone, lead! Losing hydraulic pressure!"
Ammo gone. They must have been in a hell of a fight. Blanchard and Jagdeer had the lead and screamed down into the path of the bats, which both broke immediately. Blanchard whiffed out on a good guess and began to climb after one of the soaring locusts. Unusually, Jagdeer misjudged, and the other bat went under her. It was tight, but Markwell managed to pull a brake turn and spill into its roll. He fired. The forks of Lazshot were incredibly bright in the low light. The locust evaded and turned high. Markwell followed it. He was concentrating hard, but not so hard he missed the call from Jagdeer.
"More contacts! Closing! Ultra-fast!"
Markwell tried to look everywhere at once. Where were the new ones? What angle? The locust tried to throw him with a chandelle, but Markwell nursed over on vector thrust. He stood 9-9 on its end, let the tail slip out, and turned a tumble into a swing-over. The locust was going for Walden and the lightning again. A bright flash lit the sky, and for a second his instrumentation sobbed with electromagnetic interference.
"Bat down!" Blanchard called. He'd blown the other one out of the sky.
"Eight!"
Jagdeer called. "I'm on it." Markwell executed a barrel roll and swept down after the locust, which, against the dark shroud of the forest, he could see only on the orspecs and by the light of its engines. He pulled in, chasing hard, saw its engine flare slide through his gun sight, corrected, and got a lock tone. He fired. He hit something because there was suddenly shrapnel in the air. Where was it?
"It's going high! It's going high!"
he heard Walden yell. Markwell looked up and saw the locust powering up into the violet sky on a vertical track, suddenly visible as a sharp silhouette against the pale light. It was trailing smoke. He'd hit it, at least, and driven it off. The Vox crackled.
"Umbra lead! Umbra lead! Is that you?"
"Copy that. Larice!"
"Affirmative. We are inbound to your position. Converging. Be advised. Bats! Bats! Bats!"
Markwell heard Jagdeer curse. He pulled up and round, and saw the sky above and to their south full of specks and sparkles of light. Larice and Zemek running for home with 10+ machines on their heels.
"Eight and two, with me," Jagdeer called. "Four, we are crossing to intercept. Can you commit?"
"Negative, lead. Zemek and I are nil ammo. Repeat, nil ammo."
"Understood. Burn for home. We'll deal."
Markwell saw two hot lights flare up to his port side as Blanchard and Jagdeer hit the burners and blasted towards the incoming formation. He opened his own throttle and soared in after them. Zemek and Ash, cooking at full, streaked past under him, rocking 9-9 with their jet wash. The three Thunderbolts scorched into the leading edge of the Locust Pack. The air went wild with dazzling streamers of crossfire. As the bats fired, it seemed like a whole constellation of flashing stars had come out. Markwell felt the shudder of near misses, and then a flat slap as something kissed across his port wing. He squeezed the gun stud, then rolled hard, getting into grip position instinctively as he pulled 4.5 negative. There was a vast fire splash to starboard, and Markwell was dazed long enough for him to almost collide with a locust coming fast the other way. From the whoop on the Vox, Blanchard had evidently scored again. The bats had broken high. Markwell gunned 9-9 and began a climbing turn. His Orspec's display was just a mass of confused green blobs. He couldn't make anything out. Something went by him, turning higher and wider than him. He reckoned it was Jagdeer. A locust streaked down past him, guns clattering. He rolled around and spotted Blanchard powering low over the forest, chasing two bats with another pair mobbing at his heels. Markwell put his nose down and streaked after the pursuers.
"Eight! Break! Break! Break!"
That was Jagdeer. Markwell had already heard the whining of the lock alarm. He punched over left, then rolled back right and fluttered his speed brakes. The tone ceased. Something went over him, turning. More throttle again, climbing now. The bats Blanchard had been chasing had split, and he was alone with locusts firing at his tail, stuck tight.
"Break two!" Markwell yelled. "Break!
They're too tight, riding me!"
Nose up, Blanchard's machine shuddered and yawed as Lazshots chewed into its fin tail. In desperation, Blanchard executed a vector brake, but up rather than down, so that the two bats whipped under him. By then, Markwell was tight on them. and he went under Blanchard, too. Blanchard had braked too hard and was now trying to recover airspeed before he stalled. One bat disappeared, pulling out so suddenly Markle couldn't tell if it had gone high or low. He came in on the other, emptying his batteries, and then toggling to quad cannon for a second lengthy burst. The locust suddenly sputtered out a gout of flame, which flared rapidly into a wide, spiraling fireball and ignited propellant. The bat's doom was so savage that Markwell had to break off to avoid the blast. He had made his second kill. Jagdia banked over, lined up, and ripped a locust out of the air as it attempted to swing under her. It went over, shaking like an autumn leaf, and caught fire. Another two streaked past her, but Blanchard was on them, firing like a maniac. One blew out, becoming a cloud of sparks that sailed on, slowed, and then began to fall. The other broke south. Something lined up on Jagdia's bird so fast that the lock tone surprised her. She took three hits that kicked the tail of her thunderbolt high and caused a mass of alarm runes to light her display. She fought the stick, stiff with diving speed, and kicked the rudder out to port, piling on the G. She grunted with effort, bringing the nose round. And there was a banking locust, moving a touch too lazily, like a gift from the God Emperor himself. She was set on quad already. She fired, a sustained burst, enjoying the way the shudder impaired 02's stable flight. Mortally wounded, the locust dipped its nose and began to dive. A long, steady curve of fire trail marked its passage from air to ground. There was a vivid flash amongst the trees below.
"They're breaking,"
Blanchard voxed. She banked wide, checking her auspects. "Confirm that, too." The remaining bats were fleeing south in a loose line.
"Pursuit?" asked Markwell.
The boy's blood was evidently up.
"Negative 8. Turn for home."
They cruised back through what was now night, each pilot isolated in the darkness. 9 kilometers from Gosal FSB, a large area of forest was ablaze. In the darkness, the nets were back and the Lumen Barrettes were lit. Umbra 1, 2 and 8 followed the shine down and settled perfectly on their mats. Lake Gosal, FSB, 2102. Rackley hauled Markwell out of his machine. The fitters were running in for afterflight. Vapor fumed the pad. Already the shimmer netting was closing. The Barrettes had been killed, and stealth lightning resumed over the base. Markwell pulled off his helmet. The night air smelled good. Insects were screaming in the thickets and under the dark trees.
"Okay, pilot,"
Rackley asked.
"About time I started a tally,"
Markwell said. Rackley grinned. It wasn't done for a pilot to stripe up a single kill, but once it was more than one.
"How many should I put, sir?"
Rackley asked. "Keep it modest. I got another one, Rax."
"Number two,"
Rackley yelled, and the ground crew began jumping around and cheering. Several ran up to shake Markwell by the hand. "There was a fire in the forest," Markwell said, trying to make himself heard over the jubilation.
"I wouldn't know about that, sir,"
Rackley said.
"You better go to dispersal."
Markwell nodded and patted 99's flank. "Look after her, Rax," he said.
"Will do, sir,"
said the chief. The fitter crew gave him a series of hearty cheers as he left the mat deck. Weighed down by his flight armor, Markwell limped down the path, through the trees, towards operations. There was a commotion there. Still wearing their flight gear, Larice Ash and Zemek were in the process of recounting some furious dogfight to Del Ruth, Cordial, Ranfrey, and Van Tull. Base crew and some Raptor pilots gathered around, listening. Markwell saw Blanchard standing in the shadows of the awning outside operations, talking to someone. He went across. The cries and laughter from the gaggle of pilots was loud and vigorous. It was Kautus standing with Blanchard. Both men were smoking low sticks. Markwell saw how pale and drawn Blanchard was. The older man smiled as he saw Markwell.
"Over here, Vander,"
he called. Blanchard shook Markwell's hand.
"Thanks,"
he said.
"For what?"
"I think that double stern attack might have stung me if you hadn't been chasing them down."
"Rubbish.
You got yourself out of that one." Blanchard shrugged.
"Well done, by the way. Two, was it?"
"I wish," said Markwell. "One, clear and definite. I hit another, but he stayed up." Kautus reached into his robe pocket with his left hand, pulled out a silver stick case, and opened it, offering the contents to Markwell.
"No thanks, father," said Markwell.
"Such a clean living boy,"
Kautus said to Blanchard as he put the low stick case away. In his other hand, the priest held a bottle of Amasek.
"How about this, then?"
Markwell took the bottle and knocked off a finger that burned in his mouth, then his throat, then his belly. He handed the bottle to Blanchard. To your three kills, sir. What is it now? Blanchard took a swig.
I forget, Vander.
He passed the bottle back to the priest. Do we know what happened yet? Markwell asked.
Not entirely. What I've been told is the flight got into serious trouble on the edge of the desert. The lightnings had picked up something important, and then there were hostiles all over them like a swarm. 40-plus machines. From what Ash has said, it must have been a monster of a fight. One of the lightnings was stung almost immediately. Then another of them got a kill, and was promptly killed itself. Meanwhile, our three went into the brawl. Walden splashed two, and then Ammo zilch. He pulled out and started to nursemaid the remaining lightning, which had been shot to crap and was running home. Ash and Zemek stayed on station and kept going until they were out, trying to buy Walden and the lightning some time to get clear. We're waiting for gun-picked confirmation, but allegedly Zemek bagged four, and our dear Larice got nine.
Nine?
That's what she says.
Blanchard nodded. Blanchard had made three, Jagdeer two. Amazing scores for one sortie. Zemek himself put them to shame. But nine.
Nine.
That made Markwell's triumphant one seem so paltry.
Nine,
Markwell said again.
Seems so,
said Blanchard.
She's a foxy one, said Cautus.
That must be a record,
Markwell murmured.
I've not heard anything to match it,
agreed Blanchard. The bottle came back to Markwell. He wiped the snout and took another sip. Nearby, the crews were clapping and cheering Ash as she reached the climax of her turn-by-turn account. Knocking back a drink, she leaned over and mashed her lips into Zemek's. There was laughter and whoops. Zemek, a clean four. The new hot stuff. The new one with the shine. Markwell turned away.
Who belonged to the fire I saw? He asked.
Blanchard looked down.
Walden,
he said. Walden had guarded the wounded lightning back home, every step of the way. Just short of the FSB, his damaged bolt had given up and dropped nose down into the rainforest. No chute, according to their lightning pilot, who had landed safely. No chute. Someone came out under the awning behind Markwell, and Blanchard stiffened. Markwell turned. It was Jagdeer. Oil still smeared her face. She looked grim. Come in, she said. The three of them crossed to her.
What about the others?
Blanchard asked. Leave them, Jagdeer said. They're having fun. I don't want to spoil it. They walked into operations. Blanchard and the priest stubbed out their sticks before entering. Blager was there, leaning over a display intently with Oberlitz. The operators sat at their stations. Commander Marcinon sat at a desk, reviewing pict slides on a backlit writing slope. Kills confirmed, Jagdeer said. Two for me, three for Mill, one for you, Vander. Good work.
Thank you, Mamselle.
Zemek got his four. Turns out, from the picts, Ash got 10. Cautus whistled. Unheard of, said Jagdeer. Though by the look of the footage, the sky was so full of bats, it would have been hard not to hit something.
Why so grim?
Blanchard asked her. We've studied the recon data the lightning was so desperate to bring home. Jagdeer went over to the light table and cycled up some images into the projector. Hololithic shapes formed in the air.
What's that?
Said Cautus.
I can't.
That's armor, father, said Jagdeer. Seen from above at high altitude. Stork tanks, mostly, but also lines of main battle tanks, troop transporters, and some super-heavies.
It just looks like specs,
Cautus said. Markwell stiffened. He was more used to reading aerial pics than the priest.
Holy throne,
he sighed. Summary count is 9,000 units, Jagdeer said. Coming in out of the deserts. These enlargements here modify for dust cover. See this? Identified as the sigil markings of the Blood Pact.
They're coming north,
whispered Blanchard.
Undoubtedly, said Marcinon, coming over to join them. The arch-enemy clearly believes its air war has been successful in hammering the littoral. The ground forces of Chaos are now invading. I have sent word to the coast. The evacuation is being stepped up. I somehow doubt we will be ready in time.
What about us? Asked Markwell.
Us, boy? Marcinon asked.
So we're in the direct path of this. The enemy land forces must already be in the forests.
Yes. Orspec's returns paint them 60 kilometers south and moving fast. Operations has ordered our immediate withdrawal. Us and all the other FSBs in the forest region.
Transports will arrive tomorrow at 0800 hours. Jagdir looked at Markwell and saw his sadness.
Time to retreat, she said. It happens,